Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, co-host and friend Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil in the ones and twos. Special episode today because we have two special guests. New Hamilton County Sheriff Charmaine McGuffey will be guest number one. Really looking forward to having her on and talking about, she's a couple weeks into the job now. And also, she's back. Former Inquirer, food writer, restaurant critic, Polly Campbell. I know you all love her. She's been a special guest of this podcast many times. She's out with a new book. So we're going to chat with her in our, we're going to call that our That's So Cincinnati moment of the week. Polly Campbell talking Cincinnati only food. You don't get it. I keep saying it. You don't get much more Cincinnati than that. But first, Sherry, another day, another controversy. You just dropped your head. Another day, another controversial development deal project in the city of Cincinnati. This one at apartment building at Elm and Liberty. Before we jump into the ins and outs and what's going on with that, around the project, you hear this phrase, affordable housing, as being brought up around this project. First of all, when you hear that phrase, term, whatever, affordable housing, Sherry, what does that mean?
So it's technically a complicated math problem, but let's face it, neither you nor I like math. And that doesn't mean anything to our readers. So if you break down the math problem and you really look at it, it's like that your rent costs less than 30% of your total income, your total family income.
And that's defined by the U.S. Department of
– correct. That's a government. That's a government.
Housing and urban development. Yep.
But – you know, that means a lot of different things to a lot of different places, because when you're looking, when the government's figuring this out, they're not here. They're not in Over the Rhine. They don't know about this project that's being built at the corner of Elm and Liberty. Mm-hmm. They're looking at Cincinnati's overall income level and kind of, you know, basing this 30% on this whole area, right? And so it varies in Cincinnati, especially. It varies by neighborhood of what affordable housing is. And then you take that one step farther and, you know, because that could mean that's a math problem and it's based on, you know, your income and your rent. That's anybody. But so that could be, you know, your P&G worker, your Kroger headquarters worker, and, you know, they are making a good salary and they can afford a studio apartment, and that studio apartment is 30% of their income. So that kind of technically matches the definition of affordable housing. Hmm. But when you hear city council members talk about affordable housing, and we do, day in and day out, this comes up, there is a shortage of real affordable, quality affordable housing in this city, because there's plenty of substandard housing that would meet this definition, but nice places to live that are affordable. That is a huge issue in this city that no one seems to have the solution to. When they're talking about it, they're talking about a place where, you know, this is a lower middle class family can live in a nice place and have a, it can be an apartment, and their children can have bedrooms. And it's not just this two-bedroom or a studio. This is a place where people can live comfortably with their families. And so the at issue this week is the idea of, is Over the Rhine being gentrified, over-gentrified, pushing people out that are these families that have lived there for a very long time, and it's becoming too expensive to live there, and they have to move somewhere else into this other kind of housing, you know, affordable housing somewhere else, and there's not enough in Over the Rhine. So there's an overarching topic this week, and there's a development at a critical point where it has, you know, been in the works for 4 years. It's being dropped in council's lap at the very last second as an emergency, and I'm using air quotes right now. And a developer that's like, hey, this already went through a lot of process, and it doesn't have any affordable housing in it. And council's like, well, how about you put some in? Like, that's not how development works. You don't say the night before it comes up for a vote, why don't you put some, you know, different kind of housing in your giant bank approved, you know, city planning approved project. And it has all come down to, you know, what the city needs with affordable housing. And it is a big, fat fight.
Reading from our Aunt Randy Tucker's, almost called him Andy Tucker, Randy Tucker report this week, our development reporter, the total cost of the 3-acre development would be $80 million. It's a few blocks long, and it's near, you know, it's right around the corner from the new FC Cincinnati Stadium. You know, one of the quotes in the story you and Randy and Dan Horn wrote too yesterday, and the headline, you know, says, quote, "Our city cannot be bought and sold. OTR project ignites fight over housing."
Ooh. So what happened over the weekend is I knew this project was coming up and I had been planning on writing about it in like a simple way. Like, this is the project. It's coming before council. What's going to happen? And there was a Facebook post that, you know, really kind of went around by a smaller developer in Over the Rhine who's on the community council, which the community council is voted against this project in, you know, not an overwhelming no vote, I have to say. Not close, but not like everybody's on the same page. But it did not pass community council. And so this person, Danny Klingler, he wrote an open letter to Mayor John Cranley and to city manager Paula Boggs-Muthing. And he alleged some corruption. And we did some vetting of that because, you know, the developers gave donations to Mayor John Cranley and suspended council member P.G. Sittenfeld's, you know, PACs, their campaign PACs for spending. And so we kind of took a look at that and, like, there's no real allegations of corruption. This quid pro quo, this isn't like, you know, what we're seeing from the federal government. Fair enough point, though. Who's giving? I think that you're going to see a lot more transparency in what the Inquirer is doing when we're writing about these projects and who's giving and who's taking, especially as, you know, the council and mayor's race heats up. So the letter got at that, but then it talked about there's a lack of affordable housing. Then there's a press conference. And so this really just became like this very public discussion, even before it got into council chambers on Wednesday, before the Economic Growth Committee.
And so now what? The council is going to,
so, you know, honestly,
shelve it or for now, or
so it was dropped on council at, you know, seemingly the last minute, even though it's been through these other processes. Council hadn't seen it, and, you know, it's a $19 million tax incentive is included in this, and they hadn't seen that. And so that deal is really okay, and that's what made people say, well, if we're going to give $19 million, shouldn't we include some affordable housing at this last second? So this is a very hard conversation because on one hand, everyone is saying, well, council members should not have a say in these development deals. That's how we keep corruption out. And then the administration needs to do this. These professionals do it and then bring it to council, which is actually what happened. But council doesn't like it. And so should you say at the last second, council, you can't kill a project at the last second? But then we're asking council to say, you don't get to see it till the last second. And it's a mess. But what we had yesterday was fascinating. And we kind of were talking, you've written about this in your columns with, we have these, you know, three new council members, you know, technically four with Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney, in the idea that is there going to be a new majority? So what we saw come out of the committee meeting when we're going to vote on this is we saw these Republican council members, you know, speak in very pragmatic Republican terms that we can't. Their message was, you can't stop development. You don't want to deter developers. If they think that this is going to be the process and at the last minute they're going to be asked to include things in their project that aren't already in it, they were like, we can't do business like that. Yeah. And Betsy Sunderman said, you know, if this is, we really want this, then it needs to be a policy, which I thought that point was a good point because lots of things get, you know, policy, right? Plenty of people are talking about affordable housing, but, you know, maybe put in writing what you really mean by that so the administration knows when they're, you know, doing the deal. So what we saw happen, come out of it, we saw a vote out of committee. You have the three Republicans, Liz Keating, Steve Gooden, and Betsy Sunderman, plus Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman, an independent who's the chairman of that committee, 4 votes. You had other council members sit in on the meeting. They could not vote, voice a lot of the concerns about the affordable housing part of this, and these are the Democrats, right? And so when we're recording this podcast, it's supposed to come to a vote, and then we're really going to see what that's going to be. We do know it's going to be tabled, because even though yesterday at that committee meeting, they were like, well, overnight, we're going to fix this. I was like, I don't think that seems like something that you're doing overnight. This isn't an exam you're cramming for at the last second. It's a gigantic project that has bank funding. It didn't seem like something, you know, when the committee meeting ended at like 4 o'clock, that they were going to be like, oh, well, we'll just add this all in overnight. And so it's going to take some time. I'm expecting, you know, some words to be exchanged at council. And that's where we are. And is that, I know, one heck of a primer. I'm sorry, but it's going to set a tone, I think, for what's going to happen with development for the whole rest of the year with this council, and I think really shine a light on what people want in their next council members.
Sounds to me a little bit like August of 2017 and the Cincinnati Children's Hospital development deal, where it seemed like it was I hate to use the phrase done deal, because it's never a done deal till it's voted on. But it sounds, I'm just going by what I've read. I have not talked to sources about it. I did get a text message from a City Hall source saying this person's concerned that it could be similar to the Children's Hospital deal.
I've heard that a lot today. That is really, I think, where people were taking yesterday after listening to the meeting themselves, right? I have to tell you, that's not something was really made me think about affordable housing in the city.
Yeah.
Because it is something that I've written about and Dan Horn's written about, and I'm getting ready to have a story about next week. And so it took it in that direction. But I think a lot of people are saying what you're saying in that there are some comparisons being made behind the scenes there.
And so when you talk about getting policies in place, establishing policy, law, expectations for how to do development, it's just, I'm sitting here and I'm feeling, you know, like, gosh, remember all that fight? What was it? Almost 3.5 years ago.
I mean, the Children's Hospital vote was an expansion of your Children's Hospital, which at face value, you're like, it's the number three or number two, depending on the year. They kind of fluctuate a little bit back and forth. We are very lucky to have Children's Hospital, but it is located, you know, near Avondale, adjacent Avondale, and they had bought up some property and they were really going to change part of what Avondale looked like. And Children's Hospital, it was not a secret. It was a plan, and it had been unveiled to much hailing, and thankfully we have all of this. And at the last minute at City Council, there was a big push by then, you know, candidate for mayor Yvette Simpson, that the neighborhood really needed to be compensated for what they were losing, some of their character and their history. And this became a defining moment, honestly, in the mayoral race.
It was.
He wrote a lot
about
it. John
Cranley won the race based on that issue.
Yvette
Simpson lost the race
because
of that.
For these payments to the neighborhood that would go into charitable
from the city, from the city taxpayers. And so,
well, in the hospital, it would be from the hospital, right? The hospital was going to pay.
Oh, the hospital, right?
They were asking,
but
the
you're
hospital.
Right, and then, right, correct. The hospital, a private entity, they were asking that or demanding they pay millions of dollars over to the neighborhood, and then where does the city come in? Well, unless you do this, we're not going to vote for the zoning of it. I don't want to get into all the ins and outs of that again, but the broader, bigger picture is, here we go again and again. And you know what? That cuts to leadership. That cuts to leadership from the mayor's office. That cuts to leadership from the council and, you know, and the administration. And I mean, how many more times is this going to happen? And I'm not talking about the happening, whatever the intricacies of the development deal and all that. I'm saying, how many more times is this going to happen from a leadership standpoint, when we're going to kick the can on establishing policies, rules? Hey, this is how we do development. Again, here we are in this willy-nilly, like, oh, okay. And this developer thinks, hey, we're ready to roll. And at the last minute, something else comes
up. Their bank thinks they're ready to roll.
Right. And it's like, let's establish something here about how the city does development and roll with it.
You know what, though? They can't get to that. First of all, it's very complicated, and they all fail very differently. Like, do you solve affordable housing? Through income. And you rise people up through income equality and making jobs and creating these jobs and making sure people go to work. Or do you help this on the back end with more creating more affordable housing? And then who should do that? Lots of cities are grappling with this. Let's not pretend otherwise. Like, that is. But they spent like 2 years on a property tax, working group that made plenty of recommendations like they always do. And I have to say, I barely wrote about this because a lot of it happened, yes, the meetings were in public, but there was just a lot of talk. There was no will inside City Hall to do what this group had sat around putting together. And the only thing that really came out of it is they capped property tax, the residential, right? If you're going to build, you get a 10-year residential property tax abatement in the city for 10 years, which is actually its own issue, right? Should the city be doing this? But it is a policy and they do this. They capped it at like $750,000. So like only the richest people, if they're building a house somewhere in the city, they're not going to get that. They did that at the last second. So there's like developments in the pipeline that were like, hey, we're telling our people that they're going to get a tax abatement. And now you're telling us no. There were some angry developers who came into council. This was all right in the middle of what was going on with Jeff Pastor and P.G. Sittenfeld being arrested on federal bribery charges related to development. Of course, they're fighting those charges. I know. I say that every time that I get that. There's just, allegations out there. So that's what came out of that. There's not a will to make a lot of changes. There's just, I don't know if they're too different. If they can't, they promised. Did they not promise they were going to get along?
Well, that's what I was getting ready to say. I'm sitting here like my blood's boiling, Sherry, as you're talking, because they were elected to address these problems. You roll your sleeves up and you get it done. Stop worrying the hell about what I'm writing or what Sherry's writing or what someone's tweeting about. And then this is to the mayor and to the council. Get it together. You talk a big game about addressing poor people in this town, then address it. Help the least of these and figure it out. Figure it out. That's your job to do it. You've been elected to do it by the people. So figure it out. Figure out how to do jobs creating projects. Figure it out. It's just you get so frustrated because it's can kicking and it's talking and it's like, text messages about, you use this adjective to describe me in your column or whatever. And it's like, to hell with that. You were elected by the people. It's like, you just feel like a broken record saying this. You're elected by the people. You're paid by the people. It's a pretty good gig. You get a lot of media coverage. It's like, get it done. Start doing something.
It's a promise that they made. And it needs the real big solutions. It needs people to take a look around the country of where it's being done the best, and public discussion that it's not coming in press conferences or, tweets. And it's hard, but the time to do it is not 24 hours before a project is coming up for a vote.
If the council needs some phone numbers on some people to talk to about this stuff, about how to fight poverty, I got plenty of numbers for you. Kevin Finn,
Strategies to End Homelessness. He does all of the coordination.
That guy knows what he's doing. He knows what he's talking about. Call him and ask him how to do this.
We also have some of the foremost, and they know this to be fair, we have some of the foremost experts in this country. We have University of Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky University, Xavier University. These aren't think tanks, but they're producing, and people are doing the kind of work there. Greg Landsman, he did, I would say, the most substantial poverty-solving initiative came from Greg Landsman, it's like 2 years ago now, which was the eviction prevention legislation. And that took him like a year to put together. And it was based on a lot of studies, I believe, that were done at Xavier. And of course, way more can be done on that, but it was a start. And the kind of things you do expect your city to do, and it shouldn't be like super special that we did it, but because there's a lack of like a lot of other things on this, it is something special that this council did. And I do, I know we can talk about this. This is like, this conversation is such a huge conversation. But I do, I'm going to throw, you know, a little bone to Mayor John Cranley on this one. He had a jobs program when he ran for mayor, and I really hope, you know, we would roll our eyes.
What happened to it?
Both John and Roxanne Qualls, who ran against him, had jobs, you know, they had press conference where they unveiled real job plans that were, you know, these papers and here's what we're going to do. But it is, and so, and they elected John, and John did do his, the hand up initiative.
He did?
He made
where is
some,
it now?
It's hard.
Yeah, it is hard. Fighting poverty's hard.
It takes, I mean, real solutions take a lot of money and not, you know, what this council really has been.
And you got to stop living in a la la land that you're going to solve poverty. Like it's just not going to happen. The approach has to be that you're going to fight it and you're going to reduce it. And you're never going to be able to completely wipe out poverty in your city, in your country. So number one, lower your expectation on that and start to really roll up your sleeves and address it and fight it and reduce it. And, you know, John Cranley, you're right. He had a good jobs program. What the hell happened to it? Where'd it go? Exactly. Let's bring on, I got to calm down and we got to,
I'm looking forward to having Sheriff McGuffey. This is a hopeful. We're looking back. We're 8 years into this administration. I mean, Wendell Young was elected in 2010. You know, Chris and PG were elected in 2011. We're a decade in
time for change.
Leadership.
Time for new leadership.
We're turning our, you know, attention to Charmaine McGuffey. She was elected on her hope and her vision for criminal justice in Hamilton County. And so let's look ahead here.
All right, special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast, and just really pleased to welcome to the podcast for the first time Hamilton County's new sheriff, Charmaine McGuffey. Sheriff McGuffey, welcome and congratulations on your election.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, and hi to Sherry, too. I appreciate you guys having me on. Thank you.
How have these first, 2 weeks now, you're into the job? Middle of the third week. How's the job been so far?
It has been wonderful, actually. We are all smiles. I know that, you know, as we move along and the workload gets a little heavier and you incorporate more things, particularly with justice reform and the things we're going to do. But these first 3 weeks have been wonderful. And not just for here, not just for me and the command staff, but for the entire sheriff's department. I think everybody is very excited to bring some change. And they're very excited to come to the table and tell us their ideas, which is exactly what I want the line staff to do.
So I think let's start and let's go all the way back, because I mean, we could go way, way back, but I mean, I can remember writing a story. I was the county reporter when Jim Neal became the sheriff, and he made you the first female major.
Right.
Period. But you were over the jail. And I can just remember that was like a new day at the sheriff's office and like meeting you that day. And it has, I think it's fair to say, been a wild ride.
Oh, yes. And little did we know the roller coaster that we got on. It was a wild ride.
So you had worked there a long time at the sheriff's office, right? Retired. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. 33 years.
Mm-hmm. And what made you want to come back?
You know what? I missed the sheriff's office. I miss the people that work here. I miss the prisoners. I miss the jail. I missed my life in uniform. You know, I spent 33 years of my life, and really, you know, I can say virtually every day I got up, I put this uniform on. I've always loved wearing it, and it suits me. So the job suits me, the people suit me, and I just always enjoyed it.
What do you mean when you say you miss the prisoners? Because honestly, in all of the talk that we talk about the sheriff's office and policy and who should run it and who's the best candidate and all these larger conversations, so little conversation is about actually the people who are in the jail. Like, what do you mean by saying that you miss them?
You know, over the years, the bulk of my experience has been inside this jail. From a young woman, I mean, I walked in here in my early 20s, and I do, you know, unfortunately have to say some of the prisoners that I knew back then, I still know now, coming back into the jail. They're still coming back. And the thing that that worries me is why. And the other piece to that is the fact that I got to know people when I was working in the jail. And you know, there are boundaries that you set as an officer. You are the authority. There are things that have to happen. But in general, you know, you get to know people and you get to know their circumstances, and you can certainly understand why they're where they are. And the other piece to this is appreciate them. I appreciate their senses of humor. I appreciate their life experiences. I mean, you know, and they have lots of them. So, yeah, so I do. I miss the prisoners.
Sheriff McGuffey, I want to even go back even before that. And I know Scott Wardman's done a lot of great stories on you and talking about your history and coming up in the sheriff's department. I'm just curious, like, to let listeners know, how did you get interested in law enforcement, you know, before you went in and got hired at the sheriff's department?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as a young girl, I lived in an at-risk neighborhood, and I was an at-risk kid. My mom was a single parent who worked very, very hard to provide for us. And, you know, a lot of the times we were on our own. I had two sisters, and we lived in a neighborhood where the other parents were in a pretty much similar situation. So we all ran around together as kids. I mean, you know, and it really was a culture of the oldest kid was in charge, whoever the oldest kid was at that moment. And that's whether you were playing sports or walking to the store or whatever you were doing. And, you know, I tell people that's where I learned about social justice and what happens when you have the wrong kid in charge and the way yeah. you can get, you know, led down a path when you don't have that good supervision. And, you know, and the other piece to that is my mom was always very fond about talking about how we were, what job we were going to get and how we were going to support ourselves. That was a very common conversation in our house. And I decided, hey, you know what? I'd like to be a police officer. I saw so many of them I admired. And so I, you know, told my uncle that. Well, of course, most people know the story. I was told, you know, you can't do that because you're a woman.
Hmm. What year was this?
That would have been in the late 60s. Actually early 70s. I'll take that back. It was in the early 70s, probably 1970 or so, that I announced that. And there you go. And it was true. I mean, it was absolutely true. It was a rule, a law. And in fact, I went to University of Cincinnati, and it wasn't until I graduated with my bachelor's degree that they actually did let women, you know, work in uniform out on the street.
When you were elected back in November, did you think back to that when people had doubted you and said, you can't go into that because you're a woman all those years ago? Did that cross your mind in that moment of victory? And if so, what was that like?
Oh, you know, it crosses my mind very frequently, because as a young girl growing up, I heard the word can't way more than I heard the word could. Hmm. And, you know, I remind myself lots of days that, you know, there for the grace of God go I. And that is exactly why, you know, I give credit to the community who helped raise me, because that's true. Our neighbors, Cincinnati Recreation, my teachers. If I hadn't had those extra adults in my life, I don't know where I would be. But yeah, I think about that frequently. It's important to remember where you came from.
Is that something that you're cognizant of when you were choosing your current staff?
Oh, it absolutely is. I wanted the current staff a couple of things. One, I wanted them to reflect the neighborhoods that we serve, and I wanted them to bring an energy to the table, an intentional energy that is one that embraces justice reform and change. And these are people, every person that come to the table thus far, and we're still filling positions, but those people are energetic and they get it, and they just can't work hard enough to get it done soon enough.
We hear that term, phrase, whatever, words, criminal justice reform a lot. I think in today's, you know, society, politics, certainly in politics and campaigns. If someone comes up to you, they catch you coming out of the sheriff's office, hey, Sheriff McGuffey, I hear you talk about criminal justice reform. What does that mean?
You know, it's interesting you should say that, because at one point in the campaign, one of my opponents referred to justice reform as a buzzword. And that let me know that my opponent had no idea what he was talking about, because anybody that's worked in this business for any period of time understands that justice reform means taking a system that breaks people and breaks them down and affects their lives in so many tragic ways, that is a system that needs to be changed. And community engagement is a huge piece of that reform, you know, and it's one of the reasons I'm so excited to have the liaison unit that is all about the community. Justice reform means bringing people in. I know exactly what it means, and I can tell you there's a number of people out there that know exactly what it means. It's far from a buzzword. It's the real deal.
How much can you do on your own as elected sheriff? And how much do you need, like, the Hamilton County commissioners to understand what you're trying to do, or Cincinnati City Council understand what you're trying to do?
You know, I can affect, and we here at the sheriff's office can affect a great deal of justice reform, because we run the jail. There are almost 1,300 prisoners in this jail. We affect their lives. We affect what happens to them, and there are lots of ways that we can improve. The other agencies that you mentioned, hey, you know what? They're helping us too. All of them have a role. I know that the county commissioners, I mean, we've got Alicia Reese on here now. Yeah, I'm going to give a shout out to her. Oh, she's fantastic.
Female, speaking of, you know, powerful women, right? Breaking the glass ceiling, which is something we saw yesterday with Kamala Harris, but an all female county commission. I don't think enough is being said about that, honestly.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. I mean, and Denise Driehaus and Stephanie Dumas. I mean, I really just can't say a good, you know, enough things about them. They're committed people. They're, you know, boots on the ground, and I'm looking forward to working with each and every one of them.
Sheriff McGuffey, you've been in law enforcement, what you said, 33 years up until, you know, now, and you have a great reputation of also being, and I don't want to say this as a cliche, but, you know, hey, you're tough on crime as well. How do you balance being tough on crime and the criminal justice reform? I'm assuming it's probably a pretty delicate balance, right?
Well, there is a bit of a fine line you walk, but in general, both of those ideals need to join up, and they can join up. They are connected. And when I say I'm law and order, I mean it, and everybody knows I mean it. And that just means we're all going to follow the rules. It doesn't matter, you know, what your station in life is. It doesn't matter if you're wearing the uniform or not. You're going to follow the rules, because here's the thing. Our children our elderly people, our neighbors all want to have a safe and good community. Everybody really wants the same thing. We all want to feel safe. We all want to feel that things are being done right and being done fiscally responsible. And, you know, I've always been a person that calls it like I see it. If I see a wrongdoing, I'm going to call it out. And it doesn't, you know, whoever did the wrongdoing that I witnessed, I'm going to call it out. I think that's what we should all do. And, you know, I do support law enforcement. You know, these men and women that work in this uniform, in this black and gold, and wear this star, I have watched them, many of them, blood, sweat, and tears. And I mean heavy on the tears sometimes. And the tears come from the tragic situations they see, just how hard they work. When bad things happen, they're there to pick up the pieces. And, you know, that's what makes me law and order. And we're committed to serving Hamilton County with accountability, respect, dignity, and transparency.
So, I mean, you do call them like you see them, and it's something that became very public in the idea that while you were doing your job, you called out use of force issues in the sheriff's office. Did it give you pause to do that, thinking about your future? Did you think about yourself, or did you just think, I have to say something in that moment?
I knew I had to say something at that moment, and I did not think about the consequences, quite frankly. I trusted the system. I am a part of this system, and, you know, criminal justice isn't just a word for me. Justice is real. And I brought to the table what I felt was important for people to know. And, some things happened behind that. I stand with my convictions always.
Were you surprised at there was a backlash inside the sheriff's office? People were upset.
To say that I was surprised is an understatement. I was shocked. I was in shock. I'd never seen anything like it in my career. I was used to people in uniform bringing things forward that were legit and credible and having those things worked out, okay, and having remedies. Never in a million years did I think I'd be called into the sheriff's office and summarily fired in less than 20 minutes because I brought forth concerns. And that's exactly what I did. I brought forth my concerns. And I expect every officer who ever wears the uniform to do the same.
And you have a whole internal affairs process being put in place to make sure what happened to you never happens again. Is that right?
That's correct. I am very, very proud to say that I have brought on board a woman who is a major, Major Tish Schuler, and she is heading up our Internal Affairs Division. She has quite the career. She spent, many, many years with the State Bureau of Criminal Investigation. She's been all around the state. She's had many different specialties in investigation, investigating lots of things. She understands, and she and I talked about it. She didn't just come in here to pound on people. That's not the right way to do it. But she came in here to give us the best, the most, expertise and fret out the facts. And, yeah, I think the public is really going to be satisfied with that pick.
So you were fired. You won your lawsuit. You were elected in the midst of all of that, kind of all together. And today, right. I mean, do you feel – today we learned that there was an award to your attorneys of $240,000 by the judge. That is a massive amount for attorney's fees in this county. And, you know, we don't a lot of times like, oh, well, what happened with the attorney fees in the cases that we write about? I mean, what did you think about that when you heard that?
I think they earned every dime of it. I think that those attorneys that represented me, oh, my goodness, there were mounds of documents and paperwork and interviews and, you know, what they created here at the sheriff's office to justify my firing was it was something I've never seen in my career, and I don't think anybody else ever has either. It was a massive amount of documentation of gossip and all innuendos. And I mean, just, and quite frankly, I'll just be frank. As I said, I call it like I see it. I think that was by design, because to defend that, to fret out the facts after all that, was, they earned every dime of it.
So there was, you know, now you have this history. As the incoming sheriff, did you have any conversations with Sheriff Neal? Did he, you know, were lots being said, like, you know, President Trump left a letter for President Biden. Did you talk to him? Did he, how did that go with the transition?
We did not talk. You know, when I won the primary, Jim Neal texted me late that night and said, "Congratulations, J. Neal." That was the text. And I just text back, "Thank you." That was the last correspondence I've had with Jim Neal. And that was right after the primary. And, you know, we did not transition. Obviously, there was a lawsuit in play, and that made some things a little difficult for the parties. And quite honestly, I knew that the people I'm bringing to the table have so much expertise, and I do have expertise. I ran three quarters of this department for almost 5 years. The transition's going very well.
Did you get any you know, I saw we had Scott had a big story last week on you were making changes among, you know, top folks in the department. My thought on that has always been like, hey, a new sheriff comes in, they bring in new top folks, a new CEO comes in to Procter & Gamble, they bring in new, you know, top executives, a new mayor, a new general manager, a baseball team. It seems like a pretty standard, you know, approach to the job. Did you get any backlash though? I thought I saw some people criticizing, and it's like, why?
Yeah, I did. I did get some backlash on that. I don't know why. I really don't, because you're exactly right. It's what everyone does. I shouldn't be expected to do anything differently. As you can come over here and sit in on one of my command staff meetings, and you'll see that the people I brought to the table bring a wealth of experience, knowledge, and yeah, every coach wants their managers. I mean, I don't know anybody that would do it any differently.
So I have like the longest standing question in the history of the sheriff's office. You mentioned earlier that there's 1,300 inmates in the jail right now. And of course, we're under a consent decree to not overcrowd.
Right.
Does this county need a new jail?
This county does not need a new jail. And I'll tell you why. We can fix the one we have. We just need to get in there and do it. And that's not to say there aren't hard things to do. Oh, there's hard things to do. You know, we need to find alternatives for, you know, in the way of community corrections for low level offenders. We're working on things like improving the food. We're going to work on things like just today. In the staff meeting, we created a more, you know, addition to the policy for the prisoners that are in medical and mental health units, that they get good linens. And I mean sheets and a blanket that's very clean, that's in good shape, and so forth. And, you know, those are small things, but those are things that improve people's lives. And when they walk out the door, they're a lot less likely to reoffend when we get them healthy and whole again. So I don't think we need to.
Are you talking about treating people with dignity? Is that what's the underlying premise there?
That's exactly right. You hit it right on the head, Sherry. It's treating people with dignity so that when they walk out of here, you know, they feel confident enough to seek help. It takes courage. It takes health. It takes a lot of things to seek help. It's so easy. It's just too easy to walk down to the corner and buy heroin. It's just too easy for people who think, what else do I have? So, you know, I'm not a pie in the sky. Okay. I am very law and order, and I'm very rooted in reality. I promise you that the years in the jail, you know, they make you know that reality is real. So, you know, but when we can, and I believe we can do so much better.
Do you feel like there might be you whenever there's like stories like nationwide, like about prisoners, they have TVs, sometimes they have computers, like, and people are like, inmates deserve nothing. There's always that kind of backlash to stories like that. What would you say to those people?
I would say to those people, please remember, those inmates are getting out of jail. They're getting out of prison. At some point in time, they will walk back into your neighborhood. And would you rather have them be more enlightened, perhaps have a different frame of mind, perhaps feel enfranchised enough to join the community and want to say, hey, I want to do well? The way to do that is build them that way, not create a situation where all you're doing is punishing them day to day to day. I mean, you know, you just can't do that with people and build up self-esteem. And that's my philosophy. And I tell people, look, we're building it from the front. We are spending a lot of money, but I do promise you this. I'm watching every dime and every dollar. I have great fiscal people, and we're going to do what we can with the money we're afforded. And, you know, that's part of reform right there. Let's change the mindset. I know that there are people mad. If somebody stole my computer from my car, I'd be mad. Darn right I would. Would I want them to be incarcerated? Probably. But would I also then later want them to not be a ward of the state for the rest of their life for that? I mean, certainly I realize. So I know that's a minor crime compared to some of the things we house inmates for here in the Justice Center. But the idea is they're here. It's real. And let's deal with it in the most upfront, you know, best way possible.
And our listeners should know that you didn't just start this on January 4th, this approach. You know, obviously you became the sheriff at the beginning of January, but this was your approach when you ran the jail as well. And one of the things that you did along those lines, you were very proactive in how to tackle the opioid problems that you saw coming into the jail. Talk about that, and then
Are you still seeing that?
Yeah, and are you still? Yeah, well, that was the other thing
I want to
ask.
We talk about the pandemic so much now; it's you know not right in the headlines as much as it used to be.
Right. Yeah. Oh, we're still seeing the heroin scourge on our community. We're still seeing addiction come in our jail at a high rate, and we're still seeing mental health issues. But you're right. As the major, it was my goal to I use this analogy. What I did is I filled in the moat and I dropped the drawbridge and I put the welcome sign out, because Cincinnati, and it's one thing I learned even more on the campaign trail, is we have so many people in this community that are willing to give and give us their expertise, what they have to give to help people. I mean, we are very agency rich. And, you know, I wanted to marry that to our justice system, and that's what we did. And we reaped great rewards for that. Everybody that I brought in to minister to the prisoners and so forth, we did all that without costing the sheriff's department a dime. And that's the great people of Cincinnati. Yeah. I love this town. I absolutely do. And I think we can become a model for the nation. That's my goal.
You know, we were once a model for the nation with our juvenile court. And with juvenile court comes the overseeing of the Juvenile Justice Center, which is the juvenile jail. And that has not been in the headlines a lot lately. But I've been thinking about, we did see that Republican Judge John Williams was defeated in this past election, and now we do have a Democrat judge over at juvenile court, which oversees the juvenile jail.
Carrie Bloom.
Yep. So is there any coordination there? Because it used to, before like the recession, and I was covering courts, it had these so many programs for these young people and the school and, you know, doing some of the things you're talking about now to make sure they don't stay in the system. What kind of coordination, if any, is going to be happening there? Because that's really the front end of things, the children.
Oh, tremendously so. Yes, you're exactly right. Right on point. I met Judge Carrie Bloom on the campaign trail, and I am so impressed with her. Wow. I think, yes, to answer your question, she is going to bring some cutting edge to those programs, to what happens in juvenile court, and along with the other people that are already there, the other Republican judges, Democrat judges. You know, I work across the board, and there are good people on both sides of the aisle. And I do want to say that, yeah, we're going to join forces because we talked about that a lot. And I've talked about it with the other judges, too.
It really is this whole system. Everything fits together because where the funding comes from and policies that come down from the judges, of course, now it's a majority of Democrat judges and how they treat things, how bond is done. It is the justice system is not a jail. It's not a sheriff. It's not a police chief or a police department. It's everybody.
That's right. And that's why in this day and age, we need to elect people that communicate well, that get along together. That's the key. If we can't get along at the top, how in the world are we going to connect all these programs? And, you know, as I said, I work with everybody. I enjoy it. And that is the key, I think, Sherry. You're exactly right to bring it together.
Do you have a good relationship with Chief Isaac, or is this a new relationship that's coming?
Well, it's a newer relationship, but I do have a good relationship with him on the campaign trail. I did meet him for coffee and just to chit chat and so forth, get to know each other. And I liked what he said, and I liked what I heard him say. And, you know, I rode with him in the Martin Luther King motorcade. We were in our sheriff's car next to his Cincinnati car, and we did that on purpose to make a statement. You know, we are going to bring excellent service to the city, whether it's the black and gold or the blue. So yeah, he's a great guy.
Did he have any advice for you?
Oh, he did have advice. You know, make sure that you do an audit on your property room right away. Okay.
Practical advice. Okay.
Yes. Oh, yeah. He was super helpful. Oh, my gosh. I talked to him about we need to bring on a public information officer. And I mean, what they've done with their public information over there is tremendous. And he gave me advice about that and, you know, how to get that started. And yeah, he was a wealth of information. And I look forward to a great working relationship with him.
And that would be Kyla, right?
Yes.
You hired Kyla Woods?
Kyla Woods is here. She is our public information officer, and she is tremendous. I tell you, again, and I said this earlier this morning, even when you say her name brings a smile to my face. That's how, you know, bright and positive she is. And she's going to do a great job for us.
These
former
roles,
TV reporter.
Yes.
So people might recognize her for the name from that.
But yes.
These roles are so critical of getting the information out, whether it's in a crisis, whether it's just, you know, after a shooting and letting people know what's happening. And I think they are sometimes like the forgotten people, because we always want to quote the sheriff or the police chief. Right? We're like, oh, like, well, that's where we want the quote from. But I promise to everyone who's listening, before most of those interviews happen, we have talked to the public information officer, who's been very helpful to make these kind of things happen.
Right. That's exactly right. She has a huge role here. Huge. You know, she's coming in. She's learning our department. She's understanding, you know, what our mission goal is and our mission statement. And she's been just so helpful already. But you're exactly right. You know, transparency is not just a word here. It's real. And she's a huge part of that. She's going to bring transparency, and it will be intentional.
We like that.
We'll hold that, too. Yeah.
Hey. So, yeah, absolutely. It's a good thing.
You know, I could talk to you all day, obviously, and we've had many great conversations in the past. But, you know, yeah. I didn't want to make this the focus of this interview because we have said a lot about this, that, you know, you're LGBTQ. This is very important. You got national attention for that. But I wanted to make sure that we focused on who you are and what you're doing. But I don't want to leave that out. And we talked about, like, you being a woman and what that means. But what does it mean to you being a lesbian, and how important it is that, you know, that you've made that public as part of who you are?
And I thank you for bringing it up. And I also thank you very much for not making it the focus of this interview. I absolutely am proud to be here as a member of the LGBT community. You know, I've lived in Cincinnati all my life, and I love Cincinnati, but I will tell you, it was a very, very conservative town to grow up in. And, you know, so many of my friends, including me, we lived in fear for many, many years. We were all very fearful that if someone found out we were gay, we would lose our jobs. We might lose our housing. We might lose, you know, we would lose our family connections. And it was quite stressful and quite frankly awful to feel that way. And to be able, I know the way that I was outed was difficult, but in the end, you know, the silver lining to that was that I got to start living my life as a, you know, as an out, you know, lesbian. And I can't tell you how tremendous that was, the weight it lifted off my shoulders. And the fact that I can be here in that, you know, and that be a part of who I am is, wow, it's tremendous. And it says a lot about Cincinnati, I think, in a good way.
I don't want to leave it out there, like how you were outed now, because I think our listeners might not know. I know it was difficult, and now you're saying that you can look back on it with some perspective, but can you tell us what happened?
I sure can. And, you know, it is difficult to talk about, but I decided when all of this happened to me in the beginning, when I was fired and all these things and I've gotten all this press, you know, I told myself at one point, you know, Charmaine, you're not going to survive unless you embrace this. And so I am very transparent about my life, where I used to be very private. So, yes, I was leaving a gay bar in Covington, Kentucky, and two officers were stationed up, angled at the bar door, began to yell at us. We were in a crosswalk going to our car. That was it. There was nothing else going on. I spoke out because I recognized it immediately as them targeting a gay bar. I spoke out against that. And there was some issue with that, with one of the officers in particular who took issue with that. And I said, hey, you guys should not be targeting a gay bar. So for that, ultimately, I was given 3 tickets. I was written tickets for disorderly conduct, public intoxication, and menacing. That was summarily dismissed almost immediately, well, within a few weeks, because there was no merit to it. I'd done nothing wrong. And that was that. So, so then I was outed because by policy, I have to report that to my department, which I did the very next day.
What would you say to those deputies now?
You know, I would say, hey, how you doing? Let's shake hands. Life goes on. No hard feelings. You know, truly, in this business, you live and learn. And if you don't know that, you haven't been in this business very long. You live and learn that some of the things, sometimes when you zigged, you should have zagged, and, you know, things happen. So that's part of being a professional in uniform. I hold absolutely no grudge, absolutely no resentment.
I want to, you brought up, you know, the old Cincinnati and the way Cincinnati known as a, I remember, you know, when I came to UC in the early 90s, I remember hearing that, you know, that was kind of known as the most conservative town in America. And, you know, I give Chris Seelbach, the councilman, a lot of credit for really tackling you know, this issue. And, you know, thinking back over all those years, did you ever think Cincinnati would come to the point that it's come to now as being a LGBTQ friendly and a really welcoming town from that standpoint?
Oh, no, I never did. I never thought that I would see this day, and that LGBT people would be treated as well as they are now. And I just never thought it. And I'll tell you this, growing up in our community, and I realized I was gay when I was 16. And, you know, guys like Scott Knox, who's an attorney, a prominent attorney in this town. I never knew Scott. I wouldn't have known him if I bumped into him on the street when I was young, but I was so thankful he was there because he was out and he was an attorney. And we all knew hey, you know, here's somebody you can go to. Here's somebody who will help you. And that was the same thing when Chris Seelbach made his run. You know, all of us, it made us all feel safer and more secure for those guys to be so courageous and step out. And I'm so thankful to them.
Has anyone said that to you yet? That they're thankful that you're you and you're the sheriff?
Absolutely. You know, I do feel like my representation at this level is important. It's important to people of all from all walks of life. And yeah, and I'm glad if people from the LGBTQ community appreciate this and appreciate me, I'm thankful for that.
Well, we're thankful for you coming on today and joining us and being on the podcast and sharing your story and the work sure. that you're doing. And I want to say this. Tell Mary Carol Melton hello, that she is, I'll tell you.
Campaign great manager.
your campaign manager. And I'll tell you, great, you know, behind-the-scenes folks are few and far between. And you hired a great one in Mary Carol, and she's just a true pro. And so tell her we said hi.
Oh, I will. She is a force of nature, let me tell you. Wow, she's been so tremendous. I can't, again, you know, we could spend another half hour me talking about Mary Carol and how great she is. So thank you for that. I will certainly pass that along.
Thank you, Sheriff.
All right. Thank you both. I'll see you soon, I hope.
Bye, Sheriff.
Bye-bye. All right, we got a special episode today. Two guests on our That's So Cincinnati this week. Pleased to welcome back one of our favorite guests of all time on this podcast. This is, I don't know, she's been on this podcast three or four times now. Polly Campbell. Polly, how are you?
Yes, I'm very good. Thank you.
You've come out with a new book. I read in the Inquirer. Former. Retired now, Cincinnati Inquirer, Cincinnati.com food reporter, food critic, restaurant critic. Polly, new book, Cincinnati Food, A History of Queen City Cuisine.
So welcome, author Polly Campbell.
Yes.
Thanks.
Can you tell us about your book? I mean, I can remember hearing like snippets of it, but that's just because I sat near you.
Oh, sure.
And tell us kind of how this came together and what it's about.
Okay, yeah. Well, I always feel like I ought to write a book, you know?
Wait, Polly. Me too.
What?
Me too.
Yeah. I know. Well, I got the idea of writing about, it suddenly occurred to me that a lot of the fun things I had written about food and people in food in Cincinnati over the last, you know, especially more recently over the last 10 years or so, often we're inspired to do new things by history, by Cincinnati's always, you know, just history that just keeps on giving. You always find something in the past of Cincinnati that's very interesting. And so a lot of people, a lot of things come back around, or people are inspired by the past, or it just happens again. And so that's the basis of the book. And, it's based on a lot of stories I wrote. So like, for instance, you know how Vine Street, well, this is all pre-pandemic. We'll see how it all works out in the end. But, you know, Vine Street became this great place to go eat out and wander and drink and see your friends and so on.
I know. It seems like magic. It's always been like that, but no.
Yeah,
no.
Well, it wasn't always, but at one time it was really like that. It is nothing compared to the beer drinking that went on in the 1890s, say. So that was fun to read about, find out about that.
And so this is more than just a collection of stories you've written and that we've read in the paper. You're taking the perspective that you've had from your long career at the Inquirer and knowing about the food scene and spinning it forward with just the history.
Yeah. It's a history, but it doesn't start out in, you know, 1789 and then move forward one thing at a time. It's like, it's only the history of things that still exist, the stuff that we still eat, the things that have happened. Why, you know, why we have so many neighborhood bakeries and that make so many kinds of coffee cake, or, you know, where Ghana came from, how Findlay Market has changed over the years, that kind of thing. So everybody can relate to the history because it's about things that they can experience now.
Did, what was the one thing that you knew that was going to be like, this is definitely going to be a story that I'm telling in this book? What was like kind of the first thing on the tip of your tongue?
You know, I think this is not the most important one, but the thing that really clicked for me was Skeleton Root Wine, where a local winemaker remade the wine that Nicholas Longworth got famous on back in the early 19th century. I thought, that is so cool. This is a, you know, Cincinnati was the wine capital of the country at one point for a short time. And this woman was so, Kate McDonald of Skeleton Root was so interested in it that she found the old ways of doing it and she recreated it. And that's sort of the prototype for the kind of story. Obviously I knew Findlay Mark in there. We had to talk about Chile and I had to talk about Geta and everything the Germans did.
Oh, you've caught my attention now. I haven't read the book, so I'm not going to pretend that I have. But okay. That was going to be my question.
What do you think, Polly? I think we should give him an assignment to read the book. Thoughts?
Well, I think. You can write a short 4-page paper on it.
I think it's probably a safe assumption that the book is being called Cincinnati Food, A History of Queen City Cuisine, that Cincinnati style chili has a huge, huge presence in the book.
Yeah, it does. And I think a couple of things that I start the chapter on Cincinnati chili with a quote from
You said you started the book with Cincinnati chili?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I started the chapter about Cincinnati chili with a quote from Deadspin, because at one point they made so much fun.
I remember that, yes.
Do you remember that? They had like the best specialties from all 50 states. And then they had Cincinnati chili as number 52 with 51 as a car wreck. So they really didn't like it.
Hey, Polly, hang on a sec. I'd like to point out that Cincinnati chili is still around. Deadspin is not. So keep going.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. But what really, the reason I included the quote was he said, that what they said about Cincinnati chili was exactly what they said it was sort of a corporate faithless thing that had no connection to the people and the culture. Like, that was exactly 180 degrees incorrect. Or is that 180? That's what Cincinnati chili is. I don't think there's any city that has the culture around a particular food that we have, you know? And that it really is a folk food. It's for everybody. It's everywhere. And that's just something I love about it.
No, and it has been super important to us, as Alex and I aren't from here. And, you know, it takes a minute to understand Ghana and Cincinnati chili. And we do understand it now and like it. But
same here.
That really came about when trying to make it part of Jack's childhood, because at a certain point I thought, can I send Jack Coolidge to school? And he'd be like, Skyline, what? And it is his favorite thing. And it's special when we have to do something, we go there. And it's very important to him. It is ingrained in our history.
Yeah, it is. And it's a different history. You know, it's one of the things that wasn't German. It was invented by people from the sort of intersection of Bulgaria, Greece, Macedonia, et cetera, and is sort of taken over by the Greeks here who run the chili parlors. It's funny because I got really into chili because I was pregnant at the same time a good friend of mine was, and she's from Cincinnati, and she would get these terrible cravings for chili, and so I'd go along with her, you know, and that was when I got completely converted to it.
That's when I converted to Ghana, Polly. Alex was like, I thought you didn't like Ghana. I'm like, no, I love Ghana. And can you go get some?
That's funny. Yeah. So, yeah, that's it, it just, thinking about that Deadspin article, there was another quote I have in there about from Chicago in the, I think it was the 1870s, where they're talking about how you can tell a Cincinnatian. And it's like, well, they always have sausages with them. They're like have a whole rope of sausages coming out of their pocket at all time, and they're always eating sausages. They're just, they're crazy about sausage. And I just love it that Cincinnati kind of has that, like, I don't care what you think, Chicago. I don't care what you think, Deadspin. This is what we do. This is what we eat here. Whatever, you know?
Dang right.
So, yeah.
Dang right. So, Polly, also, did you address city chicken in the book?
No, I did not. I did not go into city chicken.
What?
I did not cover every single thing.
Okay.
But city chicken's a good one. I like that.
Which you and I have discussed before on this. I can't remember if it was with Paul or with Sherry, but we've discussed city chicken on this podcast before.
Yeah.
Because for those real, true, long-time Cincinnatians, they know what city chicken is.
And that's so funny because, you know, that pork, well, pork's still pretty cheap, but pork, chicken was the luxury meat. And so you had to make an imitation of it out of a different meat. It's kind of funny to think about.
Yes. Good stuff. Good stuff, Polly. Have you done any traveling or what else have you done during your retirement?
Oh, man. What a weird time to retire.
Yeah. When did you retire? Last June, right? I remember it was summertime. We had a big get together for you outside.
Yeah.
Was that June?
Yeah, it was June.
Yeah.
It was this last June. So
seems like it was 3 years ago in some ways. In some ways, it feels like it was 3 weeks ago.
Exactly. Time is not the same as it used to be.
Yeah, it is.
I've been getting my house in order. I worked on my garden a lot this summer. I've been cooking a lot. I've been trying to get healthy and lose weight after all those years of eating whatever I needed to eat.
Yeah.
So, it's been good. First time in my life, I've gotten into an exercise routine. And
that's awesome.
I'm ready to come out, though, of hibernation. I'm feeling a little tired of it. So, we'll see.
Us too.
Yeah, I know.
Now, are you one of those folks who are going to retire and move down to Florida or South Carolina or somewhere warm, or are you going to stick it out in Cincinnati?
Oh, it's really never occurred to us to leave Cincinnati. So
love it.
Yeah, or to leave our house. So we'll see. But no, I'm not a Florida person.
Well, I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
Being Polly. You're always being Polly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I always am. It's all I can do.
Great stuff, Polly. Appreciate you always joining us here and look forward to reading the book and reading more about chili because I know you, no one knows it better.
No, it's not a native, but I've certainly thought about it a lot. So.
Yes, you have.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Miss you, Polly. Okay.
Oh, yeah, you too. Bye.
See ya. Thanks again to Polly and to Sheriff McGuffey for joining us today. Sherry, is there anything more Cincinnati than talking with Polly?
No, then she. That's why I thought that was a good surprise guest for this week. Because I mean, if you were to ask me what I did this week, I mean, the answer would be nothing because the county is purple, and so I've been very boring. And it's January, and I was like thinking about her book, and I was like, we need to have her on as an author because she's so Cincinnati and knows about since this is a history book, and so I was like. Just do like a little extra guest, and she can, you know, help bridge from the time of us being purple to going out and being ourselves again.
Absolutely. And I'm continuing with my bad habit of saying, is there anything more Cincinnati than ...
But we are a city of that. I do think that. And it's one of the reasons why Polly could write a whole book about Cincinnati food and where it came from. We treasure our history in this city. It's very much a part of us. We're a small, you know, big city. So we're able to capture that and keep it close to us. And there's a lot of historians around. And so it's okay to say that with this, I think.
Gotcha. I think we've covered a lot today.
Yes, it's a special recording on Thursday this week. Yesterday was a big day in the country, and we just were a little late this week. But so I'm off to go cover council.
Good times. Catch you next week.